Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
It does indeed. Thank you very much, Scott. Welcome to The Exchange. I'm Wilfred Frost in for Kelly Evans, and here's what's ahead on the show today. We're in a debt-fueled, buyback-driven market, says one of our guests. He sees that extending the bull market for years. He also sees scary corrections along the way. He's here to make that case. Plus, Japan's stock market hitting record highs, but it's not too late to get in. We look at where the biggest opportunities are as we continue our trip around the world this week. And this stock down 30% from its May high, the company at the point of maximum stress. That's exactly why one of our guests likes it here. He'll be here with why now is the time to buy that particular name. But we begin with a look in on how markets are trading this lunchtime. And as you can see, we're up about 0.2% or so on each of the major averages. And that means we're on pace for the first positive day in three for the S&P and the Dow. The Nasdaq, meanwhile, is set for its sixth positive day in seven, currently on track for a record close in and around that level. 16,428 spot two is the level we're looking at. So as you can see, in fact, we're just a little bit shy at the moment, need another sort of 10 basis points of gains or so. Well, for the year, if we broaden out, the S&P 500 up about 10%, and those gains may be set to continue because my next guest says, as I said at the top, we're in a debt-fueled, buyback-driven market, and that will fuel the bull market for years to come. But it will also contribute to some scary corrections. Joining me is Brian Reynolds, Chief Market Strategist at Reynolds Strategy. And also Bob Pisani is here as well to talk us through the key talking points of this story in the buyback picture. Bob, break it down for us.
Wilfred, always good to see you. Corporate America right now is flush with cash and buying back a near record amount of stock this year after a record 2022 when $950 billion in stock was bought back. 2023 was a mild disappointment due largely to a lack of earnings growth, but 2024 is looking like a near record. Jeffrey Yale Rubin at Barini Associates estimates that companies announced $187 billion in buybacks in February alone. That would be second only to the record of $225 billion announced in February of 2022. Now, a good chunk of the buybacks seem to be driven by record profits in big tech, and that makes a lot of sense. Corporate America has recently shown a preference for buybacks over dividends and capital expenditures. The main reason seems to be that buybacks can boost share prices because they reduce shares outstanding, and in theory, they improve earnings per share. They're also a lot more flexible than dividends. A buyback, for example, can be discontinued much easier than cutting a dividend. But remember, Wilf, it all depends on cash flow. As long as that's strong, you got buybacks.
Bob, stick around with us for this discussion because there's so many areas to explore. And Brian, great to see you. In the headline, we're saying debt-fueled buybacks. I mean, and that's a good thing. Surely buybacks are a good thing when stocks are cheap and they're not particularly cheap. And when it's being funded outside excess earnings, excess revenues, but not from debt. So talk us through why debt-fueled buybacks now is a good thing.
Well, in general, the credit market's on fire. Companies have been able to borrow record amounts of debt this year. That was not the case last year. And most of that money is going into buybacks, including the cash flow that companies are driving. More importantly, is how much they can borrow. The credit markets are on fire. In the long run, that's good for stock prices. In the short term, though, it's gotten a little bit overdone, and I think we're due for a pullback.
It's so interesting you say that in the long run, it's good. I can perhaps see the opposite argument why in the short term it's good for stocks, because there's a buyer out there. In the long term, if it's funded by debt, surely there's going to be a comeuppance at some point.
Well, there's always a comeuppance. So we had the comeuppance in 2000, 2008, and in 2020. But each time that was from a higher low. So over time, stock prices go up because of the buybacks. But in the short term, buybacks lag stock prices. So last year, stocks went down because buybacks petered out, because the government was borrowing too much money, people felt. from August to October. But in October, I pointed out on this show that the government was done borrowing money. They hit their targets, and that sent the buybacks into overdrive. So we've had a move since last October through now from one standard deviation below the trend of stock prices to one standard deviation above the trend of stock prices. That's a huge move in the last 6 months. It's probably overdone. And when you get that type of a move, that's when the buybacks slow down temporarily as corporations husband their cash. They think we've done enough to boost our stock prices, and they don't start the stock prices again or the stock buybacks again until stock prices have gone down or had a correction of about 10%.
It's really interesting, Bob. I mean, Brian, I know, is not saying this explicitly, but one could extrapolate a little bit as if buybacks is the only driver for markets. And if they dry up, then they'll correct. What's your take on that? How important, Bob, are the level of buybacks for overall market levels and sentiment? And do you agree there with Brian's take that we might be a bit stretched to the upside in the short term?
Yes. Here's the problem I have. It's one thing to argue when you're buying back stock with cheap debt like it was a couple of years ago, but that's not so cheap anymore. And I think companies are going to be a little more careful buying back debt when the cost of borrowing is a lot higher. So that's one natural break that I see out there. Other than that, it's interesting to watch the competition. I've been doing this for 25 years. You've been doing this a long time, Wilf, too, between buybacks, dividends, and capital expenditures. There was a time when dividends were a lot more popular. Corporate America's pulled back a little bit because they like the flexibility of buybacks. And it is an interesting way to return cash to shareholders, providing you actually can reduce the share count. And there are some situations where they don't actually do that. Some companies are now doing dividends. Meta just announced a dividend, for example, in addition to a buyback. So there is competition out there. The key story is, what does corporate America do with the cash flow, with the excess cash flow? President Biden wants them to go and suddenly spend more on capital expenditures and hiring people. But that's really a function of the economy. So I don't have a problem with corporate buybacks. I have a problem with doing it when they're having to use debt to do that. And the cost of the debt is a lot higher.
Gents, stay there if you will. I want to get into all of this in a bit more detail, particularly the dividend argument, Bob. But we have a news alert, first of all, to bring you on Apple. We're going to discuss the consequences of this news alert that Steve Kovac has for us.
Hey there, Wilf. Yeah, so Apple's annual developers conference is going to take place on June 10th at the company's headquarters out there in Cupertino, California. This is the annual developers conference where they typically do new updates to all the software for their various devices, iPhone, Apple TV, iPad, and so forth. But the reason this one is so important, Wilf, is because this is when we're expecting Apple to make its artificial intelligence announcement. After the last earnings report, just a couple months ago, Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, teased that there's going to be what he called breaking new ground in artificial intelligence for Apple. The huge question for investors, where Apple fits into this AI revolution that we're talking about. They don't have the same kind of clear narrative that maybe an NVIDIA or a Microsoft does. So what kind of features that would incorporate and so forth. We also learned last week that Apple has been in talks with many potential partners for its AI products. That includes Google with its Gemini product and China's Baidu for its Ernie Bot artificial intelligence product as well. So huge stakes, a lot at stake here for Apple. For this artificial intelligence announcement we're expecting on June 10th. Well,
Steve, we look forward to that and your coverage of it. Let's go back to the panel. Brian and Bob are still here. Brian, why don't we touch on Apple quickly? It's a great example. I mean, it's off its highs, but not by much. And over any long-term perspective, clearly it's done incredibly well. And on various multiples, it's relatively expensive. Should they not prioritize dividends over buybacks at these levels?
So I think, in general, stocks are overdone relative to debt levels. So I agree with Bob. It doesn't make sense for companies to buy back their stock at this levels, especially for a really expensive company like Apple, because Apple's bought back their stock and seen investors redistribute it to other names. There's one other factor here, though, that also plays into Bob's argument, and that's IPOs, initial public offerings. When stocks are down, there are not many IPOs. But when they go up, that means companies want to sell stock. And we had a very successful IPO of Reddit last week. That's going to encourage more companies to bring stock to market. So instead of doing buybacks, they're going to be doing issuance, which is why I think in the short term, this is going to be a negative for stocks. We're going to go from a buyback overheated market of the last 6 months to fewer buybacks in the next 4 or 5 months. That will probably make a correction. And then when values get better, then the buybacks will pick back up.
Bob, final word to you.
Well, again, I agree here with the point being made. You want to buy back stock generally when the price of your stock is perceived to be cheap as opposed to future earnings potential. So how's the market valuing? Apple's had a little pullback recently. So there may be people out there arguing that actually now would be a good time to buy Apple with a roughly 10% pullback. Again, this is always a careful balancing act. I know a lot of people that want cash in hand. They like the dividends because it's actually real cash. And it's not something that's sort of intangible like a buyback is, where you're hoping it reduces the earnings per share. It's a big debate. We should have this problem. Right now, corporate America is flush with cash. And that's what the good news is. That's why the stock market is holding up so well.
Gentlemen, great discussion. Thanks so much for that. Bob Brown discussing the debate between buybacks, dividends, and whether they should be debt-fueled or not. Right, let's go around the world, as we've been doing so far this week, and we'll continue to do this week here on The Exchange. Well, Japan's stock market hitting record highs last week for the first time in over three decades. That's paid off big time for Berkshire Hathaway, which began building a 5% stake in five of Japan's biggest publicly traded companies back in 2019. Berkshire upped that investment by 3.5% last year, with Warren Buffett saying he could be open to increases beyond that down the line. And while Buffett was early on Japan, our next guest still sees plenty of untapped opportunity from here. His Japan fund is up 16% so far this year. Joining us for more, Shuntaro Takuchi, Matthews Japan Fund Portfolio Manager. Very good to see you. Thanks so much for joining us, Shuntaro. So just give us a snapshot quickly of what the valuation multiple is on the Nikkei at the moment.
Sure, thanks, Buffett. So right now, Nikkei Index, which consists from mega caps and large caps of Japanese companies, is trading at 22 times forward earnings, which is at a 10-year high. However, if you look at the broader index, for example, like the Topic Index, it's trading about, give or take, 16 times forward earnings, which is still about a median of the previous 10 years. Japan is one of the very few markets which has a positive earnings momentum and also a positive revision that is still trading within the 10-year range. Other markets, such as the U.S. and India markets, are trading at 10-year highs.
But that's really interesting. I mean, those valuation multiples are steeper than I thought you were going to say. So I guess you just touched on it there, but talk us through the attraction of buying stocks at that price. Is Japan about to grow at 6% GDP per year?
No, I think there's still a big perception gap amongst global investors. When we talk about investing in ASML, for example, do we worry about Dutch domestic economy? But some or the other, when global investors think about Japan and Tokyo Electron, they worry about Japan's anemic GDP growth. But at the end of the day, as active investors or Japanese equity market investors, we invest in Japan corporate profit growth, which has been extremely robust over the past decade. And going forward, it will benefit from global manufacturing cycles. And on top of that, there's ample upside with regards to increased share buybacks and dividends.
Talk me through that, the sort of sense of shareholder returns and the priority that management gives to shareholders. Is there a lot of dividend payouts at the moment? What are the yields on some of the key names you own?
So currently, the Japan market on average is the dividend yield is about 2%, and buyback last year was record high at $65 billion, which buyback yield is about somewhere between 1 to 1.5%. The important thing here is corporate Japan is sitting on $1 trillion of cash on balance sheet. More than 40% of the Japan-listed companies are net cash. So unlike the U.S. companies, which is borrowing money and buying back shares, actually increasing buybacks and dividends for Japanese companies is not to decline the ROE, because the cash flow accumulation has been much faster than the deployment itself.
That's really interesting. And then just talk to me about what your assessment of what the Bank of Japan has been doing over the last 6 months is, and whether it's the right move. Like, obviously, coming out of zero interest rate policy, have they come out of that a bit slower than you might have expected, or are you ultimately content with their actions?
Yes, so I think the BOJ actions basically raising rates, moving out of the negative interest rate policy is an important milestone to actually see real wage growth in Japan happen, which is critical for domestic consumption. However, at the same time, Governor Ueda has stated that BOJ will continue to be accommodative in its stance on a relative basis compared to other central banks. And that's exactly what we need to see for the Japanese equity market, we think.
Santara, thanks so much for joining us. Great conversation.
Thank you.
Right, BlackRock CEO Larry Fink says Japanese equities have more upside as well. That's his view. And we'll hear more of that on Mad Money with Jim Cramer tonight, 6 p.m. Eastern. Big, big interview that Jim has done with Larry Fink. Extensive. The biggest money manager, of course, in the world. Meantime, search and rescue efforts continue for survivors after a container ship struck a major bridge in Baltimore early this morning. As a result of the wreckage, all vessel traffic in and out of the port of Baltimore has been suspended until further notice. This video shows the moment a 948-foot vessel sailing under a Singaporean flag crashed into a pillar supporting the bridge before tumbling into the river. Dramatic images showing the scale of the collapse that we've been looking at all day. Amy Javers is on the scene with the latest on what President Biden has been saying about the incident in the last couple of hours. Amy?
Well, Wilfred, to give you a sense of the scene right here, we just saw a few moments ago a giant flatbed truck full of floodlights pulling in. Clearly, they are setting up for some nighttime work here overnight. We're still many hours from darkness here, but plans moving ahead for that. And as you can see right behind me, they're just pulling up a couple of flatbed trucks with giant mobile offices on them. Those are being unloaded right now. You can see in your picture there. Those just arrived a few moments ago. So clearly, officials here settling in for the long haul in terms of the recovery effort and the reconstruction effort that is to come. You see behind me, that is the vessel that struck the ship. You can see it's still packed high with those containers on the deck of the ship. The ship itself is wedged under the wreckage of the bridge, right where the bridge collapsed, and that one piece of bridge wreckage still propped up on the bow of the vessel itself. That ship has not moved since about 1:30 this morning when it impacted the bridge. As of now, this is still a search and recovery effort. They said there are divers in the water. We've seen Coast Guard helicopters circling overhead, and there's some question now about the remaining six individuals who are still unaccounted for at this point. We know that two were in fact rescued, but it has been a long time since this impact and a long time since somebody was rescued here at the scene, Wilford. The president speaking in the Roosevelt Room a short time ago, talking about that recovery and talking about what his plans are for the future now. Take a listen.
I told them we're going to send all the federal resources they need as we respond to this emergency. And I mean all the federal resources. And we're going to rebuild that port together. Everything so far indicates that this was a terrible accident. At this time, we have no other indication, no other reason to believe there's any intentional act here.
So the president also saying there that the federal government will pick up the tab, whatever it might be, for reconstruction of this bridge. Obviously, a vital artery in terms of traffic and commerce and leisure travel here on the eastern seaboard of the United States. The president was also asked, though, if the federal government is picking up the tab here, what about the shipping company that was a private company that was apparently responsible for this accident? The president said, we're simply not going to wait to adjudicate all of the liability here. We're going to get moving on a rebuild. The federal government will pick up the tab. And if there is any liability, that clearly will come on the back end. It'll be the taxpayers first paying for this before any resolution of the liability issues here. As you can imagine, those will be presumably epic, Wilfred. Back over to you.
Eamon, great stuff as always. Thanks so much for that. We want to draw your attention to shares of International Paper. They're moving lower in the last few minutes as the company reportedly puts in a bid for London-based rival DS Smith. That's according to our colleagues at Sky News, Mark Kleiman reporting that. The bid could throw a wrench into DS Smith's ongoing potential merger with Mondi. As you can see, it just slipped about 0.5%. It slipped a bit more than that initially. It got down to about $39.50, but recovered a dollar or so since, down, 0.75%. Well, coming up, UPS holding its investor day today, with the stock coming off a second straight year of losses for the first time since the financial crisis. Well, our CEO, Carol Tome, what it'll take to turn things around. That's coming up next. Plus, here's another look at today's mystery chart, with shares down 30% from their recent high. It's one of the worst consumer staples over the past year, but our market guest coming up later in the show says now is the time to buy. The Exchange back after this short break.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Welcome back to The Exchange. Well, UPS shares having their worst day since January when the company issued weaker than expected guidance for 2024. Fast forward to today's Investor Day, and UPS forecasting stronger than expected revenue for 2026 as it works to aggressively cut costs. Though today's reaction suggests the street remains a little bit skeptical of their plan, down 7.4%. For more, let's welcome in UPS CEO Carol Tome, along with our own Morgan Brennan. Morgan, over to you.
All right, Wilfred, great to see you. And Carol, thank you so much for joining me on the heels of Investor Day. You're joining us from Worldport in Louisville, Kentucky, which processes 400,000 packages per hour. When we talk about this 2026 forecast, revenue of $108 to $114 billion, that's up from $91 billion last year. Adjusted operating margin above 13% for 2026 as well. These are well above street expectations. What gives you the confidence to put this forecast out, especially as we have had a very challenged market for freight and small package?
Well, Morgan, I'm delighted to join you today, and thank you for your questions. We're excited about the future, and let me make it real for you. In our growth forecasts, we're leaning into healthcare logistics in a meaningful way. In fact, we declare today that we want to be the number one complex healthcare logistics provider in the world. Last year, our healthcare revenues reached $10 billion. We plan to double that by 2026. So that's $10 billion of growth over the next 3 years. And the wonderful thing about healthcare is you find it in all three segments, in our domestic segment, in our international segment, and in our supply chain segment. But it doesn't stop there. We see opportunities for growth outside of the United States. The premium market is $50 billion. We've got lots of room to grow in that area. And coming back to the U.S., the good news about the U.S., after the small package market shrinking in 2023, it's poised to return to growth in each of the next 3 years. So when we add it all up, we're confident of the numbers that we've shared.
Okay, and I do want to dig into some of those areas of growth a little bit more. But first, this 1+2 plan to grow volume by dollar, then to grow volume with a focus on margins. This seems to be, at least according to some of the analysts we've spoken to, what's putting shares of UPS under pressure today. Walk me through the strategy and what, at least initially, investors might be missing here.
Well, 1+2 is simply based on the cost nature of our new Teamster contract. And you may recall we negotiated the largest Teamster contract in the history of the United States last year. Mm. We're very pleased with that contract. The compounded annual growth rate of the wages and benefits is 3.3% over a 5-year period, but it is front end loaded. So 1+2 is simply this. In year one, we want to grow our volume and our revenue and our operating profit dollars. And then in years two and three, we want to grow volume, revenue, and operating profit margin. Why will margin expand past year one? because we are going to anniversary the first year of the Teamster contract in August, and the cost growth rate, well, it drops dramatically after that. So we plan to exit the U.S. with an operating margin of 10% this year, which gives us a jump pad to reach 12% by the end of 2026.
So what does that enable in terms of future cost cuts and, just as importantly, future investments in the network? When you've realized almost half the cost associated with this five-year contract in year one, how much more flexibility does that give you in terms of how you want to drive the changes within the network?
Yeah, this is one of the most exciting initiatives we have facing UPS over the next several years. You know, this is our 117th year in business. The network gets old. It's integrated. So we have the highest margins in the industry because of the integrated nature of our margin, of our network, but it's old. And so with Network of the Future, we are reimagining our network. We're leaning in automation into ways we never have before. And imagine, we're talking about automating every aspect inside of the buildings. We are also going to collapse some buildings that we don't need any longer into larger, more automated buildings. We will invest to make this happen. We'll invest about $9 billion over 5 years. But in that five-year time frame, we will enjoy $3 billion of savings, of which 50% will be recognized in the first 3 years.
The market share that you lost going into those contract negotiations last year, have you been able to regain that? And I ask knowing that FedEx, your chief rival last week in earnings, mentioned that they've been able to hang on to some of the business that they were able to catch last summer.
So, Morgan, we did see volume leave us during the contract negotiation, and more than we expected, candidly. But I'm happy to report that we have brought 60% of that volume that diverted back into our network. And it's not just about winning back. It's also about winning new. We do believe that volume will be down in the first half of this year, but we expect it to return to growth in the back half of the year.
Great. Carol Tomei, CEO of UPS, thank you so much for joining me on the heels of Investor Day. And Wilfred, I'll send it back to you, but I will also note that we're going to have more on healthcare, more on international, more on the macro outlook with Ms. Tomei coming up in Closing Bell Overtime, which kicks off at 4 p.m. Eastern.
I'm well aware because I will be keeping your seat warm in your absence, which I look forward to immensely. Carol, Morgan, thank you so much and see you later. Well, turning to another part of the market, Trump Media and Technology Group is soaring in its public debut after merging with the shell company Digital World Acquisition Corp. We should note the company is now the most shorted SPAC in the country, according to data from S3 Partners, leading the journal to label it a meme stock. At the same time, we're getting new data points on how former President Trump is doing in the polls on the economy, and our Steve Leisman has the results from the latest CNBC All America's Economic Survey with some of these readings about how this election's going to break down on the topic of the economy.
I think we've identified the economic issues, Wilfred. The two presumptive nominees are just about deadlocked in the race for the White House, with President Biden's numbers. They're approved a bit and on somewhat better economic views, but former President Trump has a commanding lead when voters are asked who is better on several key issues. Let's do the horse race first. In the head-to-head contest of just these two, 45% pick Biden, and that's up from 42% in the prior poll, and 48% Trump. That's down 2 points. Look, it's a 3.1% margin of error. All of this falls within the margin of error. It is essentially a dead heat or a horse race here if you look at the margin of 46-45. The blue number's right there. Okay, here are the top one or two issues judged by our 1,000 respondents. Inflation, 81% pick it. Healthcare, middle class, overall economy, and crime. These are the top issues. Now let's look at who voters think have the best policies on these issues. Let's go. Overall economy, the fourth most important issue. Donald Trump has a 30-point lead on that. Crime, tied for fourth, 28-point lead for Trump. Inflation, the most important issue. 27-point for Donald Trump. Healthcare, Biden has a 19-point advantage on that. And the middle class, that's a place, as Wolf was talking about, where there is some battle right there. Who has the best policies for the middle class? Let's go to the second tier of issues, which aren't all that far down, but they're not in the top five. Immigration, 48-point lead for Donald Trump. Taxes, 32 for Trump. China, 28 for Trump. Come to abortion, a 25-point lead for President Biden, and Social Security, another potential battleground area. Now, you could argue it's remarkable that Biden is as competitive with Trump as he is, given some of these Trump margins on the economic issues. Perhaps it's the boost we've seen in some of the economic gauges that keep Biden in the race, or it could be, Wilf, that voters have other issues with Trump other than just his policies.
Well, I'm sure that it is amazing to look at this debate on the economy and see Biden not doing well relative to Trump. We're coming from a European perspective where the American economy the last couple of years has been the envy of the developed world. Now, maybe there's some problems to come down the line with the amount of debt that's got to be repaid.
Sure.
But it is quite remarkable that Biden doesn't score well
we
for
are
having
just,
outperformed.
We are just seeing some of those better numbers show up in our polling data. Biden's numbers have been terrible on the economy. His approval on the economy is up just a little bit from 32 to 37. His overall approval is up just a bit at 39. Not good numbers, but a little bit better. We've seen better numbers on housing, better views on the economy. Still, when we ask people, who will you be better off from financially? A plurality of 39% say under Trump.
So the other question I have for you, which is,
By the way, just real quick, that's driven by the ardor of Republicans who are very, very sure they'll be better under Trump. Democrats and independents don't think it matters much.
So where I'm interested in your take on this is clearly the Biden economy and whether you do think this has been strong or not, it hasn't been weak, in part because of massive fiscal spending. But at the same time, it's not like the Trump presidency was one of fiscal restraint. Maybe spending wasn't as aggressive, but taxes were cut without necessarily an associate cut in spending. I just wonder whether Trump is getting benefit with small C conservatives as if he's going to be a very fiscal constrained president. But he wasn't really, was he?
He was a populist president, and he was not all that fiscally constrained. He was perhaps more fiscally constrained than Biden. I think if you go back and the answer to your question is on that graphic we showed on what is the most important issue, and that's inflation. Mm-hmm. Biden gets tagged with the blame for inflation, rightly or wrongly. He spent a lot, Trump spent a lot, everybody spent a lot. The inflation happened under Biden. He gets tagged with the blame. And Trump, by the way, is seen as better, even though he hasn't really announced any policies to combat inflation. And I think the reason there is, why is Trump better? Because he's not Biden.
Mm-hmm. Really interesting. Steve, great stuff. As always, Steve Leisman there.
Pleasure.
With the All America Survey's latest results. We're still ahead here on The Exchange. We work back in the spotlight after co-founder Adam Neumann made a $500 million bid to buy the company out of bankruptcy. We'll discuss.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you. Like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome back to The Exchange. Tyler Matheson here with your CNBC News update. The Supreme Court today appeared likely to preserve access to mifepristone, the medication used in nearly two-thirds of abortions last year. During oral arguments this morning, court watchers say a consensus seemed to develop among the justices that the abortion opponents who filed suit lacked the standing to sue. Now, if that stands, it would allow patients to receive the drug by mail order without a doctor's visit. A judge temporarily blocked Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton from investigating a nonprofit supporting transgender minors, which will allow the nonprofit PFLAG to keep its information private. The Attorney General's office demanded the information last month in its investigation into medical providers offering gender-affirming care, despite a state ban. Visa and MasterCard have reached a $30 billion settlement to limit credit and debit card fees for merchants. That could help consumers save money through lower prices. The settlement is one of the largest in U.S. history. It still needs court approval. Wilf, back to you.
Tyler, great stuff as always. Thanks so much. By the way, markets at the moment just up slightly. All three major averages up about 0.2%. The Nasdaq is a point or two away from a record closing high. In fact, where it stands right now, it is there. We'll see if it holds sufficiently until the close. We'll still come here on The Exchange. Your last chance to guess today's mystery chart. It's one of the worst consumer staples over the past year. We've got the name and the case to buy the dip coming up. A clue. It's sort of related to what you might be buying ahead of this weekend, given that it's Easter. We'll leave it there. Welcome back to The Exchange. Well, Morgan Stanley Executive Chairman James Gorman weighing in on the Fed's rate and their expected cutting timeline on CNBC earlier today.
I would be surprised if they move in the first half of this year. I would not be totally shocked if they don't do anything for the rest of the year.
Well, my next guest says not cutting because the economy is doing well is, in fact, the best negative problem to have. Let's bring in Chris Grisanti, the chief equity strategist at MAI Capital Management. Very good to see you, Chris. So markets expecting three or so cuts this calendar year off the back of the Fed meeting last week. Do you really think that if what James Gorman just said was correct, that we end up getting zero rate cuts, that's good for equity markets?
Yeah, I kind of do, Wilfred. It's good to be with you again. I think that the important thing here is the economy is not just avoiding recession. It's actually getting stronger. And I think that's what James Gorman was getting at. And that's a big deal. So even, and we're getting more and more pieces of data. So for example, last week, leading economic indicators were positive for the first time in 2 years. And, you know, bears on the economy have been using leading economic indicators for months and almost 2 years now as the piece of evidence that we're going to go into recession. And it's now that's turned around. So I think the problem here, and it's a good problem to have, is that the economy is actually moving stronger. So if you're going to pick a problem, inflation's a little higher than you think. So the Fed is not going to lower. They'll probably keep the same. And we'll have some fits and starts. But on the other side, if you've got an economy that's running a little hotter, you've got earnings that are doing well, inflation's a little hotter, earnings are reported in nominal, not real dollars, so inflation helps a little bit there. So, you know, I think it's smooth sailing with fits and starts, and it's about the best negative problem you can have, that the economy's growing and inflation will be a little higher than we suspect.
So talk to me about how that might influence your portfolio strategy, your sector selection. If, sure, maybe it's not going to derail the overall headline indice levels, but would it alter your sector selection if in fact, we're not going to get rate cuts?
Sure. So great question, Wilfred. And so the tough part isn't that you're scared of a recession. The tough part is, boy, the economy, the market has done awfully well. So where do you go here? Well, what I think is important is there's a giant sucking of capital towards the Mag 7. And they're terrific companies, but you could make an argument that they're kind of getting fully valued, in some cases a little bubblish. So what I like to do is turn away from those and look, where is that capital coming from? And look at investment grade companies that are facing stresses for some reason or another. And what I like to do is find those companies at a point of maximum stress. And typically they're not in technology now because there's no stresses there. There's all good news. So, but there are some other parts of the economy which are facing what I think are short-term stresses, but that offer terrific long-term opportunities.
Okay, so we're going to get to one of those right now, and it's our stock chart of the day. We were teasing ahead to it. It was covered, so people don't know the name of it. Reveal to our audience what it is and why you're a buyer of this stock on a big, big dip.
Sure. So I'm here to talk about Hershey's. And Hershey's has a tremendous headwind right now. This is the stress that I was talking about. Cocoa prices have, take a step back. If you want an investment this year that's done better than NVIDIA, it's cocoa. Cocoa's up more than 100% since January. And it's causing all sorts of havoc with chocolate makers. Hershey's, that gets almost three quarters of its profits from its U.S. chocolate candy business, is obviously in the center of the eye of that storm. So what's going on? Their earnings have been flat in the face of those huge rises of their raw ingredients. It's because they're executing real well, but this rise in cocoa price is obscuring that execution. So we're going there. The stock is down more than 30% since last June. And we think this is a place where investors will return to. You'll get a double benefit of higher profits when cocoa prices return to normal. And you'll also get an expanded multiple as folks love the fact that Hershey will now be growing instead of just stagnant. So we're excited about that. And it's often its own kind of eddy of own cul-de-sac where folks are looking at technology and they're not looking at consumer staples right now.
Chris Crisanti, thanks so much for joining us. Much appreciated.
Good to be with you, Wilfred.
Right, still to come here on The Exchange, WeWork co-founder and former CEO Adam Neumann is bidding to buy back the bankrupt company for more than $500 million, but whether he can secure the financing is less clear. We'll have that story for you. That's next. Welcome back. The saga of WeWork continues. Former CEO Adam Neumann putting in a bid along with financing partners to buy the now bankrupt co-working firm for more than $500 million. But where's that money coming from? Will it actually all go through? Dee Bosa digs into that story for us in today's Tech Check. Dee, great to see you.
Wilf, does it feel like you never left? We're still talking about the fate
major,
of WeWork.
Major deja vu.
Exactly. And you know what? There's still a lot that is still extremely unclear. So a Flow spokesperson says that 2 weeks ago, a coalition of half a dozen financing partners submitted a potential bid. But at this point, a source tells me that WeWork has not opened up their books to Neumann. And until they do so, a deal cannot move forward. And also, it's likely that any investor that is going to sign on to Neumann's bid, they will need to see that due diligence for a final decision as well. The key question, though, as this continues, is what do WeWork's creditors want? Remember, the company is in bankruptcy. There's the current management that is led by David Tolley. He's an operator who has had stints at Blackstone and Morgan Stanley. And then there's Adam Neumann, WeWork's founder, who, as one VC put it, still managed to revolutionize the second largest asset class in the world, commercial real estate, regardless of all of those faults. So one might think of this like an activist battle, Wilf, behind the scenes, operator versus founder. And according to WeWork's bankruptcy filing last November, the largest unsecured claims come from the banks in the form of debt and real estate companies in the form of unpaid rent. There is, of course, a SoftBank in all of this, Wilf, which still has WeWork on its books. And that is a very interesting question. Who would Masa-san want running this company? Would it be Adam Neumann, who he's already given a ton of money to and lost a ton of money, or an operator who, I don't know, maybe he won't have as good of a chance of bringing this anywhere close to its glory, even before the billions of dollars of investment from SoftBank?
I was going to say, I mean, it probably comes down to whether Neumann can still spin a story like he used to,
yeah.
And Masa-san, if he's learned from his mistakes or not. I mean, where would this funding for Neumann potentially come from? I presume not a check once again from Masa-san, pure and simple.
Highly unlikely.
In that regard. But also, didn't he make like at least a billion himself? He's not funding this himself.
Yeah, it's unlikely that he would fund it himself, because you would think he has another company called Flow, which is a real estate company where he's trying to create co-living spaces. And I like the fact, Wilf, that you said he's unable to spin a story, possibly to Wall Street, to SoftBank. But you know where he can still spin a very compelling story is right here in Silicon Valley, the cult of the founder, still alive and well. We talk about who provides money. Look at that company, Flow. Andreessen Horowitz wrote its biggest check ever, $350 million. So there are those out there, particularly in tech and VC, that might sign on for a ride again.
Gosh, there we go. Well, I'll take another two-year break. I'll come back and let's see where the story
is
then.
We'll still be talking about it.
Dee, great stuff. Thank you.
Thanks,
still to come, Carnival Cruises and GameStop getting ready to report. We've got the action, the story, and the trade into the print. Earnings Exchange is next. Welcome back. We're going to the Bahamas and to the moon in today's Earnings Exchange. We're looking ahead to Carnival Cruises and GameStop. And here with us to trade these names, Jeff Kilburg, KKM Financial founder and CEO, also a CNBC contributor. Great to see you, Jeff. Talk me through the first one, Carnival reporting tomorrow morning.
Yes, Wilfred, it's great to see you back driving the CNBC boat. But Carnival tomorrow morning is really interesting because of the fact that they've trailed Royal Caribbean, despite the fact that they had a record 2023, about $21 billion in revenue, and they have expectations for a great 2024. You have to realize that this stock is still 75% off its high. But I want to be a buyer here, Wilf. There's technical support on the 200-day moving average at 1685, and I think Carnival floats on.
Very nice indeed. Okay, next one. GameStop is down 10% so far this year. Wedbush warning about softer hardware demand, especially for the Nintendo Switch, and weaker game sales as downloads continue to gain market share well off its meme stock highs, of course. But retail trader, still a bit of focus in this name. What's your take on this one?
You know what? I have to stay away from it or sell it if you own it. And I certainly don't want to short it. But if you look at GameStop, it's 80% off its all-time high, up at 120. Right now, back in December of 2023, they gave the CEO, Ryan Cohen, carte blanche to use the $1 billion in cash for whatever he thinks to buy equity. So is it a hedge fund or is it actually GameStop? So there's a lot of uncertainty there. I want to stay away from it. But from a trade perspective, you can make money being long or short. However, the earnings probably most likely disappoint because the euphoria, all that game stonk we saw just a couple of years ago, seems to have faded.
Well, GameStop reports during closing bell overtime. We'll have that for you in a couple of hours. Jeff, while we got you, just under a minute or so left. Overall, markets, are they a bit overstretched at the moment?
It seems like NVIDIA's fever will not break as of yet as it chases 950 here, maybe $1,000 it needs to print. But with the VIX at 13, certainly, Wilf, it feels like there's a bit of complacency in the market. And we're also seeing the 10-year note at 4.25. So I do get a little concerned as the quarter is wrapping up here. We're not going to see 10% a quarter. That'd be 40% year to date. So I think it makes sense for a pause. And look at 4950 on the S&P 500, Wilf. That looks like a really appropriate place for this market to back and fill, consolidate and put in some volume before we can move higher later in the year.
Jeff Kilburg, great stuff as always. Thanks so much for joining us. Quick look at markets before we leave you. We're up across all three major averages, 0.2% for the Dow and the S&P. A little bit more than that, 0.25%, though, only for the NASDAQ. 16,424 is where it stands. Four more points, 16,428. It's a record close. We'll see if it gets there. That does it for The Exchange. Power Lunch up next.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you. Like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.